You are listening to KTWHLP at 99.5 FM in Two Harbors, Minnesota.
Welcome to Living Through the End of Life and our new half-hour continuing segments, which will include topics such as grief and loss groups, COVID-specific situations, death with dignity, a chaplain's perspective, and more. This series will continue Tuesdays at 7 p.m. and Sundays at 12:30 p.m. In today's episode, I will talk with Craig Carlson, who will give us a chaplain's perspective on speaking and being with people who have been given the news that they are now at the end of their life. Stay tuned. You're listening to KTWH. I'm Katya Gordon speaking in our Living Through the End of Life series. With me is Craig Carlson. Craig is a chaplain with Essentia Health. And Craig, I know that your name has come up often as a really wonderful voice and a potential perspective for our series. Thank you so much for calling in with us.
Oh, it's a privilege to be with you today, Katya.
Wonderful. Well, let's just start about to get to know you a little bit. Can you tell us about your role as chaplain, how long you've been doing this, and, what do you actually do?
Well, I've been a chaplain with hospice for a bit over 14 years, and before that I was a chaplain in the aging services area. And, when I think about what I actually do, there's a lot of things.
Yes.
But at the most basic level, I try to shut up and listen because, all of us have a story to tell and all of us want to be heard. And so if we hear somebody's story, get to support them as maybe as they discover, hey, I'd never thought about that part of my story before. We become people who are entrusted with being with them in their story. We're not their story, they are. But it's kind of like being invited to go for a ride with someone. They're going to choose where we're going to go. And it's their car, so they're going to be doing the driving. But we might notice something along the way. It's kind of like driving up the shore and saying, oh, here's Gooseberry. Would you like to stop and look around a little bit? And that's kind of what you do with the story. Would you like to stop and look around in your story a little bit? And that leads to trust building, or maybe at some point it might lead to being a sounding board, because when we're talking about big things, we need to know what they sound like before we say them to the people that we love and care for the most. And so whether that's doing it to the mirror or whether it's another human being like a chaplain, it's a privilege to be able to just listen, and then they'll say, I didn't quite mean it that way, or that sounded really good. What did I say? and you can just reflect it back to, and getting to think about, how do I want to be remembered? And what, is there a particular process that I'd like to have as part of that memory making? But I like that analogy of riding in the car, because we don't grab the steering wheel.
Right.
We ride alongside and we sit in our seatbelt.
Right. I love that analogy also. And I love it partly because, the driver by necessity is somewhat focused on the road, and the passenger, because you don't have to focus so directly on the road, you can look around and you can notice what's happening as you go. And I think that's a wonderful analogy. I'm glad you brought that up.
Thank you.
Yes. And I love your really bring it down to the basics of just being present with somebody and going for a ride with them. I'm kind of assuming that you know, you get called when a family or a person is nearing the end of their life and they're looking for some kind of extra support on a spiritual level, probably could reflect almost any denomination or set of beliefs. I'm guessing you come up with quite a variety of not only beliefs with people, but ways of expressing it. Or maybe that's a very indirect part of what you do at all. It sounds like it.
Well, people have their values and their beliefs. And it's my job to help them unpack them so they find the ones that will help them now. And that might be quite close to the end of life. But very often, it comes, you know, earlier on. And it can come in other settings. You know, the conversation killer is, well, what do you do? I'm a hospice chaplain. And that'll usually stop the conversation in its tracks.
Really? Wow.
But then as they pause and think about it, you know, then we start talking a little bit. And we're just having a conversation. And at some point I might say to them, this is what I do. Oh. And they file it away, and there may be a future time that they use it, or at least they know they have a resource that they didn't know about before.
Right.
You know, that's kind of how I came to hospice originally. My father, who lived in Seattle, said at one time, I want you and your sister to come out here, and we need to talk family business. And so we did that, but part of talking family business was going with him to his cardiologist. And so the cardiologist ran a bunch of tests and then came in to talk to my dad. And I mean, you know, I'm a chaplain who's been in healthcare for a long time. And my sister's a clinical psychologist. But he comes in to talk to my father, and he says, Mr. Carlson, you have an ejection fraction of 15%. Now, I really don't know what that's all about, but he explained it in this way. He said, that is not compatible with life. And I have to say that, you know, that those words were clear. I understood what they meant, but they took me back. And all of a sudden, my sister and I were not healthcare professionals. We were kids. And this is our dad. And so we asked the question, well, what do we do? And he said, so, well, you take your dad home and you help him live out his days. But I think he did the best he could, but he didn't offer, oh, like, call this number and they can talk to you about some of the resources available to communities, or your dad's ready for hospice, or any of those kinds of things. Well, you know, my dad lived about another 9 months after that. And after he died, I was reflecting on it. I thought, you know, people need to know what their choices are. And so I don't want to be in a position ever again where somebody says, I had no idea.
Wow.
Now, what choice they make, that's up to them.
Right.
Because it's their life, it's their family. But they need to know, I've got choices A, B, and C. And here's what A, B, and C mean. And then they'll make the most appropriate choice they can, because if you make a choice in love, you will make it right.
That's a beautiful story. And what an example of how impactful that was for you and really led you to become an empowering agent for others. I love the idea too that you say you unpack, help people unpack their own beliefs in a way that will help them at this stage. My immediate thought was, Well, I'm going to call you when I'm in that stage. I'm going to need that. Wow.
Well, phone number will be on the resource page.
All right.
And if I'm not there, I will have a colleague there who can help you.
Okay. That really did sound deeply comforting to me, and I hope to our listeners. And, you know, so many of the people that we've interviewed in this series, when we ask where they came to be what they're doing, you know, it is obviously never about the money, and it's never about even the profession. It's really about the calling, and usually from a very personal experience that really took them in a direction in life. And it's just really wonderful to hear from you about that. So thank you for your candor with that story. And I think you answered my next question, is kind of what draws you to the profession, and even how your years as a chaplain have informed your ideas about death. Do you want to say anything about that, or how this has changed the way you think about people in general? Or, I mean, clearly you're just very comfortable with that final stage of life, which is not a comfortable topic for many.
Well, you know, somebody paid me a high compliment many years ago, and ever since they've said it, I've striven to be as worthy of that as I can. And person just said, you're not scared to talk about this stuff.
Right.
Because I remember a time when I was. You know, I grew up in the years when children, you know, you didn't talk with children about death.
Mm.
You know, when my grandfather died when I was 10, you know, there was no way that I was going to be brought to a visitation or to a funeral. And I remember having a lot of questions, and my parents could be open people, but they didn't know how to be open about death. And so, you know, I don't know that that was the opening, but it helped me realize, you know, that it is an uncomfortable subject.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing any of us has to do anywhere in our life is we have to be comfortable. Then we can decide what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can decide what we want to talk about. And it's important that people know that when you're with me or with one of my colleagues, you can be yourself and you do not have to be somebody else. Because we all have places in life where we know that's not true. And so we adapt to whatever situation. But it's important that you know that you can be yourself with your questions, with your fears, even with your tears, and that those are sacred.
Yes, I can hear in your voice that your ability to just truly be loving and compassionate toward wherever somebody is at, and that surely that feeling comes through and allows you to be a very effective assistant to somebody in their final stages. How much would you say you are meeting the needs of the person dying, and how much are you meeting the needs of the caregivers and family members and loved ones who are going through their own emotional states?
Well, the short answer to that question is yes.
Yeah.
But I think you're looking for a little more. And without putting percentages on it, it's really important to know that both a person who is dying, or no, let's rephrase that, who is aware that they are dying, because all of us are dying.
Right.
Yeah, so the person who's aware of the fact that he's dying, he's got certain questions, he or she. And they want to know things like, why am I here? What's my mark on the world? You know, if my life were a thousand piece jigsaw puzzle and it was put together, what would the picture be? They want to know who's in my corner.
Right.
To help me. And they want to know if there's something inside me that's hurting, what can I do about it? You know, a colleague said many years ago, and I'd like to take credit for these words because I think they're brilliant and they're also humble. Hmm. If everyone who is hurting on the inside wore bandages on the outside, we would be amazed at how many they are and who they are.
Hmm. So true.
And so to just recognize that that's part of our humanity.
Right.
And likewise, family members have questions too. That they want to know, am I doing this right? They want to know, is there anything going on that I can change that will make it better?
Hmm.
Or am I doing something that's actually making it harder? They want to know, what does the person who is aware of their dying think? You know, how am I doing as a caregiver in their eyes? And it's really important to realize that, you know, I may get the privilege of having these conversations, but we have a great team of nurses and social workers, even our bereavement coordinators, our volunteers, our aides, you know, all of these people are skilled in helping this stuff happen. And we all do it in our unique ways.
Right. And it takes a team, like you say. I'm sure it takes a team to do it well, each with your strengths and your special areas of awareness and all those kinds of things. Craig, can you tell us a little bit about what it's been like in the last year? Obviously, with COVID and the pandemic, you know, things have really changed, or I don't know, maybe just intensified or ramped up with everything associated with what you do. And a lot of hopelessness and trauma around not being able to do what people normally do, being physically present and having celebratory or memorial events after. So with the disruption of COVID in this process, nevertheless, there are still many things that people can do and have done. Can you share with us some of those things from your perspective?
Well, you know, I think one of the things is we've been too hard on ourselves, because I'm afraid that we've given ourselves, you know, kind of an F in caregiving as a result of COVID.
Huh.
And I'm not sure that's true.
Right.
You know, have we had to do things very differently? Absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you how different it is to engage with a patient or with a family member by Zoom as compared to sitting around the coffee table.
Right.
And I know that just for myself, I went into that and said, you know, now this is how it is, but, you know, how's it going to be? And one of the things I've learned is that a lot of powerful things have still happened. I get it that standing outside the window at a care center is not the same as sitting next to a bed. And likewise, that having a Zoom visit with someone you love is not the same as sitting there and chatting the way that you typically would have. But I think sometimes what that calls us to do is to dig deeper and to find the things that we still can do. You know, there's a book that some of your listeners may know in a very different context called The Five Love Languages. And it just talks about the ways people receive that message of, I love you.
Hmm.
You know, and sometimes it is physical touch. But it's also words of affirmation or time together or being the recipient of a gift, or of an act of service. And I think, you know, when people have made those Zoom visits or have stood outside a care center window on a hot day to talk over the phone with their dear one who is inside the care center, I think that more times than we realize, those messages have been received powerfully by the people that we want to give them to. And I think just simply, you know, I told you a story about my dad. Well, my mom had dementia, and she was in a care center near the end of her life, and we're out to see her. And it was, you know, my mother always loved flowers, so we went out in the garden. And we sat in the garden, and I could look in her eyes and see that she was looking somewhere besides anywhere near here.
Hmm.
She might have even been looking into the next world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought, well, you got to try and at least find out. So I said, well, Mom, aren't the flowers beautiful? Aren't the rhododendrons beautiful? She always loved rhododendrons. And there was absolutely no response, no verbal response, no visual response. There was nothing. Well, we stayed out for a little while longer and just kind of enjoyed the fresh air. And then we went back inside. And it just happened that the way you navigated back to her room took you through the dining room. And in the dining room, they had a grand piano. So I sat down at the grand piano, and I played for 3 or 4 minutes, something like that. And I looked over at her, and she was engaged. She was there. I'd given her a gift that I wasn't expecting to give. And I had the honor to see her receive that gift. And in that, to receive my love. And so I think about when people, you know, sing a song over the phone, or if they send a card or whatever they do.
Yes.
That it's more powerful than we realize.
I love what you're saying about that, and that there's not just one way to communicate. And, you know, in some ways, we do go on to autopilot. We have certain ways of thinking that we're going to be at the end of life or be with people. And when we can't, we kind of get paralyzed. Or like you say, we sort of tend to think we're failing, when the truth is, you know, the extent to which we endeavor to make those connections in some ways is a statement in itself that people can feel. And I know I've spoken to a caregiver in a veteran's home who has been the one with people when, as they're dying, and being the conduit between with family and holding the phone, you know, and the power that she plays as part of that. She's part of that love, too. And I love hearing these stories, Craig, and the hope that you give that maybe we don't deserve an F. Maybe we have been doing better than we think.
I kind of think that, you know, it's almost always true that when we grade ourselves lower than the person who, you know, is receiving whatever we're given would grade us.
Hmm. That's a wonderful way to look at it, and just helping us to see it the way others see it, and see things maybe, you know, when another thing I hear often is when one reaches the very few last stages in life, things become in some ways more clear and more simple. And what really matters is just these very few things, perhaps similar to the love language that you're speaking of about in reference to the book. Is there anything else, Craig, that you would like to share with us or leave with us? We are running out of time, but it's been a pleasure to hear your thoughts and your feelings about this and your stories. But I want to make sure you've told us everything you want to say.
Well, I think one of the things that has increased in importance for me through the years is to know that as we conclude this life, we find that we have some great questions that maybe we've been putting off. We've been putting them off because, well, you know, we have to take our kids to practice, or we put them off because the dishes need to get done, or we put them off because, hey, it's time to go to work. And when we get to the end of our life, if there are any of those questions still hanging around, and usually there are, those questions are going to insist on being answered. And so when those questions come up along the road, maybe you can take yourself out for a cup of coffee and think about whatever your great question is. And you won't have to wonder what it is, because it's the one that never goes away. And if you do that, that will help you to prepare and to grow in peacefulness. You know, so I think that's sort of the one thing. And I thank you for the privilege of this conversation.
Mm. Well, thank you, Craig. I'm speaking with Craig Carlson, a chaplain here in our local area of Two Harbors, Minnesota. And Craig, thank you so much again for your thoughts. I hope that you are able to continue your service for years to come.
Oh, thank you, Katya.
And I shall search my soul. I shall search my very soul.
Thank you for joining us for tonight's episode. Once again, this series will continue Tuesdays at 7 p.m. and Sundays at 12:30 p.m. in new half-hour segments. Look forward to seeing you there. A listing of books mentioned on today's show, as well as music you've heard, can be found on our website at ktwh.org. An extensive book list about death and dying, as well as area resources and archived copies of this series, can also be found there. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, please contact us at the station 218-595-6195 or email me at Katya, K-A-T-Y-A, ktwh@gmail.com. All feedback is welcome. Living Through the End of Life is made possible by a team of volunteers. Thanks to Peg Zahorik, Ellen Huffschmidt, Julie Johnson, Jan Swanson, and Chris Belfield for their production support. To Paul Hansen for his website expertise, and Bruce the Moose for putting it all together on the program grid. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.